Thank you, Alina. I wish I had my iPhone that I could read your bio from. Good afternoon, and all of you are giving up something to be here, so I truly, truly appreciate it. I know some of you are giving up lunch, some of you aren't because you're eating it right now, which is fine. And others are giving up other sessions that you may be thinking in the back of your mind you might want to go to. So feel free. If we start to bore you, just get up and leave. But I'm hoping it'll be entertaining enough. The Institute of Medicine is a very auspicious group. It is one that that I've been affiliated with in the past in the future of public health and in terms of childhood obesity on a report for childhood obesity. And it's one that collects the minds and research and even opinions from some of the really true leaders across our country in health and in science. We're really privileged, I think, to be able to come together in what we call a roundtable, which is a bit of a more casual convening than a report. I mean, there are technical kinds of meetings that the Institute of Medicine holds, but our roundtable sponsors workshops. And these workshops invite the public. They're generally held in Washington, D.C., or New York City, or in California, in Irvine, or Los Angeles, in different places. And so the public can come and listen to eggheads and wonks talk to each other and talk to the audience about some of the cutting-edge topics of the day, bringing in the best scientists, the best research, the best evidence possible to inform that discussion. And so the workshop then becomes a part of a document like you see here, this roundtable on population health improvement meeting that happened last year in July was held in Irvine, and we were able to, no, it was held in Washington, wasn't it? Yeah, Washington. And so we brought in people from all over the country to talk about the impact of the Affordable Care Act on population health. And our definition of population health is an expansive one. It has to do with the total population is not what maybe some healthcare providers might say is their covered population. So think more expansively like that. So what I'm presenting to you today is based on what we discussed at this workshop of the Population Health Roundtable. And my other speakers will be also presenting information from their workshops, but updated. So we've really updated our material so that it's relevant. The Affordable Care Act in California means quite a bit because we've gone full bore on implementation. My foundation, along with other foundations like Blue Shield and Kaiser and others, have really put some effort in pushing behind the implementation in California. I know that's not the case in many other states. And so we do have some real examples of where this act has impacted population health. And so this, what I'm sharing with you today, may resonate with some of you, and it may not resonate with others of you where there's been very little support, like in Texas. But really, the act was put into place with an idea that prevention and the attitude that this should really benefit all of the population, all Americans, all people living in our country, is one that is behind the act, and it was voiced in this statement by the president when he approved it. And this is unprecedented. Never has there been such a statement backed by such a broad and sweeping and costly piece of legislation that Congress has ever passed since Medicaid back 50 years ago. It really began, the whole conversation about why health reform and why the Affordable Care Act began, as most of you will recall, because we look at ourselves with respect to how healthy we are or aren't and how much we're paying for it. Those are probably the two biggest drivers for the conversation and for even the intent for people to think, well, we need to change things because the way they are isn't good enough. Compared to many other nations, our health is not nearly as good. We spend a whole lot more money. And really, basically, everybody from every income group and every population group and every place in America is getting a bad deal out of this. And that's been proven in evidence in various ways. If you have a lot of money and you have a lot of ability to buy yourself the best of care, that still doesn't mean you're going to be the healthiest and happiest person. There's, frankly, a lot of over-medication, as you know, and misuse of medical visits, even among the very wealthy. So we have problems throughout our system. But the IOM has looked at health in many, many, many of its aspects and looked at medicine and looked at health care and at population health through a lot of different studies that have led up to this point in time and, in fact, ongoing. So it's not only our work group, not only the roundtable on population health that looks at this, but we look at it through in the Institute of Medicine through a lens of primary care or through training or through education, through the clinical aspects of medicine or through the very public health aspects of community interventions, through health literacy, through quality, through chronic disease, and through health promotion, and even through the lens of equity. All of those different lenses have a body of work and a body of expertise and a body of evidence behind it. And we do take that into account, and we've been informed of that in our deliberations. And again, like I said, we're fortunate to have a very diverse group of experts that we can bring in and call on to bring their discipline to us and give us their perspective on how their discipline feels about population health with regard to the ACA or with regard to whichever topic. So the frame of the nexus around this that the IOM has put this in is that health strategies and interventions and policies applied at the population level can advance our approaches to our most pressing health concerns much more efficiently and effectively than just isolated, individual, categorical level actions within the clinical care sector. This is a big transformation of idea because most people believe that their health really rests on what doctors and hospitals do for them. They think health comes from a pill or a shot or a surgery. And this is why people continue to spend money on health care and believe that they're getting health in exchange for that. And that's one of the big fallacies in society that we have today, because the way America spends on health is very different from other countries. Other countries recognizing that there's much more social equity embedded in what makes people healthy, happy, productive throughout life than just medical care and medicine. Okay? And so this change, this shift really is a driver for how we think about health reform. Because despite our wealth, we're unhealthy across the board, that flattening the social gradient, meaning that our great and increasing disparity in economic well-being or educational well-achievement between the haves and the have-not getting greater and greater. If we bring that skew together and flatten that social gradient, we're going to get much better health. Transferring the overspend, because we spend far too much on medicalizing all of our issues rather than treating them upstream at the prevention end of things, we lose the opportunity through what is called opportunity costs, or spending first on medical care and then not having enough to spend on prevention, which would have been the front end of things, to really decrease the demand and avoid the medical, much more costly treatment and medical consequences. So that we know that multi-layered, focused upstream interventions in at-risk populations really hold the promise of this triple aim that many of you heard about that the Affordable Care Act is pursuing, which is better care, lower cost, and getting better health out of that equation. But what does the ACA do? It provides coverage for various populations, whether you're younger or your first time in the marketplace, whether you're poor. All of these people have benefited by getting more coverage out of that and reduce the numbers of uninsured by millions of people, over 10 million people and counting and growing, and now we're going to have a new enrollment period. Some people will lose, some people will gain, but in all, we have to acknowledge, and part of the evidence base is, that more people now are covered, millions more than had been before. It also increases preventive care, and we know that Americans like preventive care. And this is care generally done in the doctor's office, but it is the vaccinations, it is the screenings, it is the earlier interventions, it is the kind of prevention that can make a difference in terms of a health trajectory and in terms of morbidity and mortality, and there's much more investment and access to that than there had been before. And it looks like it's also controlling costs, although many are arguing that the down curve, or at least holding in terms of medical care spending and national health expenditure, maybe started and began just before the Affordable Care Act went into effect, but it seems to not be increasing the cost of care. And in fact, there's lots of co-benefits that I'll be talking about that show that there are savings going on. And it may also be improving health outcomes, even though it's very, very early. People just recently got coverage, and preventing a disease or preventing a malocurrence from happening and being able to show cost improvement already is quite a anticipatory act. But we can see that even premature baby numbers are dropping, and some of that is being attributed to the expansion of Medicaid, which happened under the Affordable Care Act, so that more women prenatal have access to prenatal care and coverage that reduces the number of premature births. Along with better nutrition and all of these other things that that happen out of our ancillary systems that bolster the Affordable Care Act. We'll talk more about that. So this system transformation has hospitals and health systems thinking upstream about the social determinants of health, about this triple aim, about community health workers being involved in the medical care team. And then some systems are creating accounting for that triple aim. But there's still somewhat of a limited financial stake that the private sector especially, but other hospitals and others that have been making a lot of money off of the medical care delivery system the way it is, change comes slow, especially when there's a lot of resource that needs to be transferred in order to create that system transformation. So we're learning a lot about what it's going to take to change that system, to pay more attention upstream to a broader swath of population, not just those covered. But it does promote equity. There are a number of provisions within the Act that talk about equity, and not just in terms of cultural competency. And it does provide unprecedented resources, such as, besides the expanded insurance coverage, health homes and workforce incentives and innovation models, community benefit programs now transferred over to the new different CDC prevention chronic disease prevention grants that a number of communities and health departments are getting now, chronic disease prevention and national prevention strategy. And that kind of a resource may not appear again, in a generation, maybe a couple of generations. Public health certainly haven't seen anything like that in a long, long time. So we've got to make the most of what has been allocated. So the CMS, Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, is developing a robust set of measures for tracking changes in population health and testing new models. Community transformation grants alone were $177 million, and now this new swath of chronic disease prevention grants is $212 million more. These are big numbers, never happened before with public health. Most of the public health funds, as you know, are really around tightly controlled categorical programs, communicable disease, maternal child health, and others that have not really allowed public health to move into a territory where they can collaborate with the medical care delivery system and get involved with disease prevention on this kind of a scale in this kind of a way. Even states and schools are jumping on board through wellness plans, and private funders like ourselves and Robert Wood Johnson and others are working on different aspects of health reform that is bolstering this implementation of the Act for bolstering and strengthening chronic disease prevention and upstream changes in the policy systems and environmental change realm. But we have challenges. Immigrants and communities of color are still disproportionately overlooked during enrollment. Of the remaining uninsured, 20 million or so in the United States still are disproportionately represented among these groups. And funding and support and capacity is limited. Providers are reluctant to invest in population health to some degree. There are certainly some great examples of those that are investing. Politics threatens the fund, as you know. We have a very adversarial Congress and political environment in Washington and a lot of states that is hostile to the Prevention and Public Health Fund. We've had experience in inability to sustain community transformation grants as an example. So questions really remain around advocacy and the allowance for that in a political environment that may not support advocacy that confronts inappropriate marketing of unhealthy food to children, for example. And then partnership development, consumer and community involvement is always a challenge but a necessity. So innovations that benefit population health, for example, the accountable care community model in Akron, and all of you should be familiar with you of that, that you're looking for innovative ways of clinical systems to work with community health systems, to work with public health systems, and then cities and government and nonprofit organizations and for-profit organizations. They really did come together in Akron and create a working model that showed that pooling your resources, pulling together to decrease, to intensify effort around control and management and prevention of diabetes works to save money, and they can redistribute that. And Massachusetts created a trust fund that has created an ongoing source of funding for community prevention, and Oregon's using community care organizations throughout its state to improve the goals of the triple aim, again, collaboration across these various sectors. So these collateral benefits, and this is the thing that I think is most important for us, is recognizing that, again, despite its faults and limitations in the Act itself and what it's doing, we have a lot of activity that is going on in the medical sector, public health sector, and communities that is increasing public awareness and support for health reform. People in general, it's on the front page many, many days. Health is an issue that is in front of the public now through the internet, through various means, media means and other means, and people are now paying a lot more attention to the cost. They're paying attention to what they're paying in the workplace, and industry is paying attention to it. So it's becoming a front of mind, much more front of mind issue, and people are becoming more discriminating about it. And I think that's to our benefit, because the more it's questioned in terms of the way it used to be done, the better chance we have of improvements coming to follow. Increased public awareness and support for health supportive community environments that's calling into question whether there are supportive safety and parks and these kinds of things. Again, more front of mind issues. It maybe grew up through the obesity prevention efforts, but is certainly circling around the health reform efforts. Consumer engagement in health decisions. Again, the internet is being a great currency for that, but increasing health literacy among non-English speaking populations, for example, through enrollment, and then going beyond that about re-enrollment and how to use your health insurance. Information technology for health and health literacy, all of these are great ways for us to be improving consumerism and consumer involvement, public involvement, making health much more transparent in terms of being a sector that is not so much of a quandary and an unknown that can use up all your money, take it and ask for more or demand more, and your health in return doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way things are going to run in the future with greater transparency and maybe democratization of health. So this collaboration involving the care sector, the public health, community health people is one where we can really improve population health. Steve Shortell from UC Berkeley summed it up in this way, that we're redefining the product from illness to wellness, and the business model is changing from filling hospital beds to keeping them empty. The delivery system needs to move from the hospital and clinic to home, workplace, and school, and the definition of providers needs to be expanded to include teachers and social workers, architects, planners, and community development specialists. This is a much broader view of health that's going to get us to what Neil Halfond from UCLA calls Health System 3.0, community integrated care or community integrated health, that really is health throughout the lifespan, health and wellness, that is greater productivity than just focusing on diseases or illness. So Obamacare will be helping us to close the health gap and contributing to population health.